Final session of this term's climate history series. So I hope you're going to enjoy it. We're happy to be finishing on a high, although obviously our speakers have been extremely interesting as well. But what's made this series really most interesting is the discussion nature of it. So that's you and the audience who are so important. So just give you a little bit of background to the climate histories project. Maybe Barbara will say a little bit about how it came about originally, and then how this project has evolved over the last year, and then I'll maybe say a little about where we're going in the future.
Okay, well, basically, I think it's tremendous that this point in term, those of you who are not taking exams may well be marking them. It's very encouraging to see this many people and a new audience, so that's thanks to today's speaker. I work in the Arctic, and I don't know how many of you got the blurb I sent out yesterday. NOAA, the North Atlantic Oceanic Administration, just sent out a message on the 31st of May saying for the first time ever, Barrow, Alaska, population 4,000, thousands of miles from any industry, has 400 parts per million of CO2 as of last week. That's the highest it's ever been. So I'm very, very interested in greenhouse gases in general, carbon in specific, both because of tundra and ocean, what happens when ice disappears off the ocean. But it also partly, although today's speaker himself is very interested in how we model very complex processes, as a social anthropologist, I'm incredibly engaged with the ways in which the people who live in the places where things are happening very, very fast are observing these changes, dealing with the changes or not. So I think that on a number of levels, today's talk is going to be of enormous importance. But as Heather said, historically, what we... Come on in. This is the right place, Kat. what Heather said initially, I just wanted to reiterate, which is that historically, these have been... These are identified, they're advertised as discussion series. So that the discussion part is probably a crucial and not extra supplemental added bit of it. So everyone participate, but after the speaker has a chance to have his say.
All right. So I think without further ado, then over to Herbert Buffett, and we'll hopefully sort of raise the discussion. But I think Herbert's going to raise a lot of questions and really get summarized the whole series that we've been running this year. Where we've tried to sort of take a multidisciplinary look at climate change, coming from lots of different directions, Barbara from the social anthropology side, I'm from the engineering side, and we've tried to sort of take this multiple perspective to see what the sort of science means for us going forward. So I'm really pleased to invite Herbert to speak as this final session this time, who I think is going to raise some of the questions about how we got to where we are, but actually where we're going from here. So Herbert, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Could I start by emphasizing that I see this as a discussion, as has already been said. I'll talk, but don't let me talk too long before you interrupt, ask questions, put your own point of view.
Thank you. In
order to facilitate the discussion and our reaction to it, I wonder if I could have a little poll to start with. I'd like to divide you by show of hands into five groups, and just to know what your background is. And the five groups are physical scientists, mathematicians, physicists, chemists, engineers, earth scientists, biological scientists, social anthropologists, economists, because I'd like to put the economists in a slightly different, or other. Now, everybody must fit into one of those. I'm a mathematician, remember. So could I just have as a show of hands an indication, those who are physical scientists, those who are biological scientists, those who are social anthropologists.
Or other social scientists.
Sorry, I had meant to say social scientist. I'm sorry. Anthropologist was just one example.
Yes.
Social scientist. And those who are economists? Oh, that's a pity. Or it's wonderful because then we can make up any financial aspects we like. Other? Is there anyone who didn't vote? Oh, quite a few others. Okay. I'm going to start with a few comments about global warming and climate change. What should we do? But I have to tell you that while I was doing something else in the lab and I left my computer, somebody from the street came in and interfered with the presentation. And I think in some sense that summarizes the problem. There are many people who believe that that's what, in a sense, we should do nothing. Now, I'd like to argue against that, and I'd like to hear from all of you what your creative ways are of going around this. Part of the background to the problem is that the burning of fossil fuels still takes up most of the way that we generate energy. Coal, oil and gas together make up some 85%, and it's been increasing over the last at least 40-50 years. This has led to an increase in the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere, as was indicated in the introduction in the early 60s when Dave Keeling didn't know quite what to do for his postdoc and thought it would be fun to go to Hawaii and measure the carbon dioxide content. He started measurements, which I liked, the fact that are now taken over by his son and continued in the family, which show a definite increase superimposed on seasonal variations. The leaves on the trees grow, they take in carbon dioxide, they then die, and they give it back. So this oscillation is understood, but it's now at something like 390 parts per thousand. Per million, I'm sorry. The temperature record, a very noisy record over the last 160 years or so, as you see here, and this is the mean average temperature. It's unrelated to the temperature in the garden there or the temperature in the highest building in Sydney, Australia. This is the mean average temperature. You see there are significant oscillations, let's call them, though they're not a definite period. There's some times where even the mean temperature will go down, but over a long time scale, it's definitely gone up. Some actual indications. This is now the change in average daily maximum temperature for something like 45 years in Britain. And you see the southern Britain has become rather hotter, something like 2 and a bit degrees. Up in the north, there's not much change, but still a significant change. But there is this definite variation. To indicate it even more worldwide, here's the December 2010 value over the average from 1960 to 1990, 30 years. There are, of course, lots of different graphs like this one can show. The first thing you notice is huge spatial variations. Second thing you notice is that the temperature increases more at the poles, especially the North Poles, than it does elsewhere. There are bits where it's negative, but in general, it's increasing. An indication of why this is happening, but just one indication, is to survey the number of cars and the ways the number of cars have increased over the last 100 years or so. 1900, there were virtually no cars around. Now in the world, there's something like 700 million cars. In the US, there's something like 250 million cars. That means on average, everybody owns a car in the US. The 5-year-olds, the 10-year-olds, on average, they own a car. Really has gone up quite dramatically. In this country, it's 140 million cars. Really quite considerable. So people own on average 3 cars. Again, to indicate there were 8,000 cars in the US in 1900, there are only 144 miles of paved road throughout the US and none in California, a slide that I like showing sometimes. Another indication, an idea that I actually got from Ron Oxborough, is to plot the extent of the sea ice coverage at the end of summer in the Arctic. So this is the minimum sea ice. If you plot the ice extent, i.e. the area, and I'm sorry, this is not right, it should be kilometres squared, as a function of the year, you see again a noisy record, but generally going down. Not always. There are some places where even over a 10-year period it's relatively uniform. There are some periods where even over 10 years it seems to be increasing. But generally it goes down. You may all know this extreme minimum that was a surprise to everybody. And I think there are two statements to make here. One, it was a minimum. And two, none of the models predicted. It came as a complete surprise. It jumped back up again and now is going down. The next slide is, I think, interesting in contrast. Before I tell you what it is, what I'd like you to notice is it's noisy, just like the previous slide, but it's much clearer that it's decreasing. This is the ice volume. This is the surface area. This is the volume. So what it's showing is that as well as the extent becoming less and less, it's becoming thinner and thinner. So we're melting the ice and forming water. Carbon dioxide and temperature have been closely correlated for at least 100,000 years, as you see here, between these two records. If I extend it even further, you see more clearly that the carbon dioxide concentration has gone up. I don't know why this shows, but not on the white. It goes up considerably in the last 100 years or so, as does the temperature, as do the carbon emissions, which we know to be anthropogenic carbon, i.e. man-made carbon. Isotopically, we know that that is true. Some of you may have noticed from my accent that I'm not English, so I'll show you. Some of you may not have noticed it yet. Jay, well, I'm sorry about that. But so I'll show you an Australian figure. It shows the deficiency in rainfall throughout Australia. Of course, in most of Australia, it doesn't rain at all, so it's zero to zero. But it does rain in Sydney and Canberra and Brisbane and Melbourne. Well, it rains all the time in Melbourne. And it does rain quite a bit in New South Wales and Victoria where crops are grown. But you see there are large areas where in this particular region were the lowest on record and some areas where there were really severe deficiency. The argument is that climate change is quite clearly already having an effect there. The Southern Ocean plays an enormous role in the climate and in the distribution of carbon dioxide. The ocean holds something like 50 times more carbon than the atmosphere. And when we put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, roughly a third goes back into the oceans. This is the Antarctic, which is a large stretch of ocean and which plays an important role. Now, some of you may think that these two slides are really just showing off my most recent holiday snaps, and you're quite right. The man at the back who went with me to the Antarctic recognises them and knows that that's what I'm trying to do. Well, that's mainly what I'm going to tell you about data that is incontroversial. Data is data in the past, and none of you have yet interrupted, and there's not much you can do. Now I want to spend some time into saying what will happen in the future. Now here, of course, I'm on extremely slippery ground. There's nothing so difficult to predict as the future, as it's been said. Sorry?
Say the ocean takes up a third.
Yeah.
Is that increasing at the same rate as shown in the earlier
slides? More or less. Yeah, that's going up also. It's, of course, an extremely complicated non-linear process and a feedback process between ocean and atmosphere. Sorry? Emily, what are you saying?
Your answer wasn't quite true.
What is the answer, do you think?
The indications are that the ocean may be taking up less, and the land may be taking up less, proportionately less.
Oh, but as I understand it, the carbon content in the ocean is still going up, and it still has gone up.
Yeah. But it's
But whether, well, I don't know how you measure if it's at the same rate. The atmosphere you measure in parts per million per year. I don't think we're talking about parts per million here. That's just not the... They're both going up. At different rates, if you like. No doubt at different rates. Yeah.
On past data, yeah. You gave lots of various figures, but you didn't plot against population. Of all the things that you've just described since 1900, really just the consequences of population growth? What's the correlation between population growth and global warming?
Gee, that's a wonderful question. I don't know. I can't answer.
I can tell you that the answer is it's a very close correlation.
Yeah.
Really, there is a very close correlation.
Yeah. Why, if that's true, why that, it seems to me, is particularly important, because I've read articles that compare the importance of fighting population growth and global warming as if they're separate questions. Oh. Are we saying that they're the same question? Which politically is an important point.
It's a growing population, yeah, with higher aspirations, consuming more.
I would say that's correct. Qualitatively, yeah. The population is increasing. That's leading to more carbon dioxide being put into the atmosphere. That there's a tight correlation. Well, if Ron says there is, then I'm sure there is. But I don't quite see how you make those comparisons, because I don't quite see what curves you compare one to the other. You can compare the carbon dioxide content and you can compare the population, and they're all going up.
What you can do is compare the use of fossil fuels with the world population.
Yeah.
And but therefore you're getting effectively CO2.
But
you're
But what seems to me part of the input to Neil's question is the amount of CO2 per person increasing also? And that's where I have difficulty seeing exactly what you mean by the correlation. Both the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and the population is going to increase, as also, especially in the developing countries, will the amount per person increase.
We can capture a lot of this if you take, surely, average income. If you took world income, that's actually a consequence of number of people and their spending ability. If you were able to plot that against CO2, you would have a very difficult political argument, because what you would be arguing is the problem increases with wealth, but that is actually the problem.
Well, one second. Could I just make one sentence, and then Ron is right that we should leave it. It seems to me that all of these things are increasing, more or less at a linear rate, so I don't quite see how you can correlate them. But you're quite right that population plays an important role here. But I would say the reason that it's not mentioned is that in general... But here, a little different. One talks, or I talk, about scientific matters and where I can use the physics and mathematics that I might know something about. Population and the decrease in population, that isn't taught in 1B mathematics, that I'm sure, and is a very difficult matter. And, you know, as we see in China, how do you decrease population? Well, I'll tell you what, one thing is slightly irrelevant, but, not totally. There's a wonderful little novelette written by Tom Kirkwood, who was the first professor of geriatric medicine. I've forgotten the name of the book, but it's the last two chapters, imagining the world in the future when it's come to steady state and how you get it to steady state. I think that's fascinating. Anyhow, we're going on to the future, now this is one of the IPCC estimates. Of course, the question is what will happen if there was a massive war tomorrow and we stopped putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere altogether, then it would be quite different. But these are the sort of estimates that they indicate. They suggest that by the end of this century, there will be an increase of another 1 degree or so, or it might be that there's an increase in another 4 or 5 degrees. Now, the general populace, the individual who said do nothing on my second slide, thinks 1 degree, 5 degrees, what difference does that make? But it does make a very big difference, because it gives much more energy to the oceans and the atmosphere. There's much more variability. There'll be more severe storms. They'll happen more often. And although 5 degrees sounds not much, it is really significant. And if I may just divert to make this clear, I was once the chairman of a meeting with 4 very eminent scientists talking on carbon capture and storage, and I had determined that each of us would talk for 5 minutes and then the audience would be allowed to ask questions, and I, as the chairman, all I would do is indicate who in the panel of 4 would answer. And one man, after an hour and a half or so, got up at the back and said, "Mr. Chairman, this is a pile of rubbish. Even you know this is rubbish. You said that there are 385 parts per million." Parts per million. Do you know what 385 parts per million is? What are you getting worried about? This is stupid. And I didn't allow the panel members to answer. I just said to myself, "Sir, would you allow me to inject you with something at 385 parts per million? Only 385, nothing." And he said, "What will happen? You'll be dead in 10 minutes, but would you allow it?" And he said, "No." I didn't know until later that 200 parts per million of cyanide is enough to do it. But it's an indication of how the general public have difficulty understanding such small values. So this is the temperature. This is now the UK summer temperature. This is showing until the year 2000 or so, the correlation, good correlation between the calculations in this Hadley Centre numerical model and the observations, and now the model is continued forward, and we see the temperature increases quite considerably. 2003, when you remember there were a significant number of deaths, some 15,000 deaths in the summer, and 2,000 in the UK, mainly due to old people. The idea is, in this calculation and extrapolation, that by 2040 that'll be the standard temperature, so we'd lose that many old people possibly, and by the 2060s it would be much larger, and at the end of the century it really would be considerable. Again, to show you the global variation and what might happen, this is the anticipated temperature at the end of the century, mean average temperature, but it is an average temperature, but shown how it varies geographically, with large increases in especially the North Pole, meaning more melted ice in that Arctic extent would be considerably less. Some places where it might not be that extreme, but generally an increase. A bit of past data fits in here. This is the observed sea level change over the last 20 years or so, remarkably constant at about 3.3 millimetres per year, increase, a little bit of variation. There are a number of countries that or cities that might be at risk of flooding. My son lives here, so I'm rather disappointed about that. Oh, and Ron lives on the other side of it, so I'd find that rather difficult. If I may add a little bit, I gave this talk in Sydney, Australia, recently, and I couldn't help saying, in fact, I put it on the slide, and Melbourne also is at risk of flooding because, you know, there's this great rivalry. And immediately somebody put their hand up and said, no, you think of Sydney as being relatively high above sea level, but when you go some 30 miles inland, it's only a few feet above sea level. It comes down again. And so I'm sure there are many other parts of the world that could be at risk of flooding. We don't want this to be the standard summer photograph. Because of that, people often get together and say we must save the Earth. And in some sense, that's what we're here for. Let me say, this is total rubbish. The Earth has been going, you may not know this, for 15 to the 15 seconds is the age of the Earth, and it's totally safe. It's going to go on for quite some time. It's the people on the Earth that we need to save, and sometimes people don't quite realize that. This begins to get to some of what Neil asks. Fossil fuel supplies 85% of the world's energy. I've already said that. There's something like 32 gigatons per year being output at the moment. The USA and China have about 6 each. Australia is quite a bit down at 0.3. Now, if you take the mean per person, 4 tons a year, Australia beats everybody. It just beats the United States, but it's roughly 20. The UK is about a half of that. Nepal, I put in because it's a small value. But, and this is a very important point, it seems to me, this mean in Australia that gets it to 20 and beats everybody is the carbon dioxide that's burnt and put into the atmosphere over Australia. It doesn't take into account all the coal that's shipped to Asia and burnt there. And there are reasons that you could argue that this should go under the Australian complement. Then the USA changes hardly at all. Australia beats it by a factor of 4.3. Then it comes up to 80. That's enormous. Now, on the one hand, that means that Australia wins by a large amount. On the other hand, the financial implications are enormous. That if, for example, Australia, which is now building more ports so that they can ship even more coal from Queensland into Asia, if they stopped that and made this go down, their economy would cause an enormous amount, well, would have great problem. In fact, the Premier of New South Wales once said the sending off and selling of coal is so important to the New South Wales infrastructure that if we stop this, the state could float off into the Pacific. I thought that was an interesting aspect of geophysics, the thought that this state would move by continental drift or something outside. What do you do about it? Well, you could change human psychology or consumption or population. I think that's difficult. I think, but are there any psychologists here? Good. I think to get people to change their habits is going to be difficult. You can do some geoengineering, i.e. change the Earth. You can have mirrors in space to reflect the incoming radiation. You can have aerosols. You can have white roofs, white roads. Just as an aside, I thought it was fascinating. The total area of roads in the United States is equivalent to the area of Texas, the whole area of Texas, biggest state. Now you might think, what about if you paint them all white? That changes the albedo and that might be sensible. A small component of paint is titanium, very, very, very small. If you painted all the roads in the United States, you'd use up more titanium than we have access to. And so I think that is a little interesting example how these fast processes have a number of problems with them. And the other question is, if they get out of control, as all things do tend to at times, I think they would have a problem. What would you do if you painted all the roads white and then the using up all the titanium and then the Earth's temperature dropped by 10 degrees and the models are not that terrific? This is an example, and I say this with some embarrassment because this is an example I've taken from an Australian colleague of mine here at Cambridge University, Hugh Hunt, who wants to have a balloon some 280 metres in diameter, lifted some 20 kilometres into the atmosphere, and the idea is that tankers will come here with some sort of sulfur dioxide, put off that aerosol, and that's meant to reflect the solar radiation. I think, again, that's a problem because it might get out of control. There are ideas of carbon dioxide removal. Take CO2 from the air. I think that's very expensive. It's not going to work. But, again, Ron knows this much better than I do. What I think is possible is capture from power stations and then sequester or store it. This is slow, but I think it's more likely to be successful. Where would you store it? You could store it in ecosystems. As I explained, the leaves take up carbon dioxide, but it's been calculated that just to store the carbon dioxide that's emitted by the power plants in England, you'd have to cover a third of England with forests, which I don't think is likely to happen. It's been suggested by, in my opinion, a very imaginative friend and colleague of mine, Dan Schrag, that you can put it to the bottom of the oceans, but there are lots. I think there are lots of problems there, acidification of the oceans. And the other point that I once made to him is, and I should say, in case you don't know Dan Schrag, he's on the President's Scientific Advisory Committee, so he has not small influence. I said, Dan, but how can you put it in the bottom of the oceans when there are power stations that are thousands of miles from the ocean? What are you going to do in Ohio and the Midwest? And he said, Herbert, this is such an important problem. We'll move all the power stations to New York. It's easy. I thought it was an interesting imaginative idea, but I'll leave it to you to say. You can put it into depleted oil reservoirs. They, after all, have shown that they can hold oil in coal seams that are not sufficiently pure, that it's worthwhile mining them, but they're very porous. There's a space that you can put in the carbon dioxide, and there's some interesting chemistry that keeps the carbon dioxide there. People have suggested mineralization, saying the Earth has mineralization all the time, but the Earth is sort of 4.5 billion years old, and I don't think it can do in the time scale that we want. I think the only possibility is to put it into saline aquifers.
So, since it's a discussion, can you go back to that one?
Yep.
I can now understand why you asked which five categories in your worm were pleased there were no economists. And I want to go to your unlikely on the consumption. And what I want to raise there, and we can talk about it later because we're coming to other things, is the fact that if you take some other areas of where we've been playing around with our behaviour as mankind, smoking and drinking. And in both of those, we're starting to move by taxation and so on to reducing the consumptions, and education generally and so on. So I've just put a question mark, and we can pick it up later. Don't answer it now, but I just wanted to flag it while it's up there.
Well, no. I think this should be a discussion, and I think that I'm being interrupted is good. I think it's interesting, and I would like to hear your view. But I would say, first of all, the question with smoking, Richard Doll knew in 1945 that smoking was dangerous. It took 60, 70 years before anything was done. And while in university circles hardly anybody smokes, in socioeconomic class 5, there's still as much smoking as there ever was. And in some countries, there's still a lot of smoking. I think getting smoking to change has been difficult. And it's true that now there are laws. Drinking, well, that's an interesting problem. And here I can speak with some knowledge because in contrast to everything else, correct. How do I put this in a better way? What the hell? Here I can speak with some knowledge because my brother-in-law is an epidemiologist, and he has very, very clean data that drinking causes problems in that it makes your life shorter, and it causes problems for the state because people need to be taken care of, and if they get drunk or they spend more time in hospitals. His approach, many people in the government, the appropriate people over some 20 years, and they all more or less say, but they don't say it in words, I'm going to say, we get taxes from alcohol. Companies go away. We're not going to do anything. So it is an interesting question. Damien.
One issue I have with the analogy of comparing what you have to do about carbon dioxide and alcohol and smoking, I think the difficulty I have is that the consequence for smoking and drinking is much more proximate than it is for carbon consumption. So I can buy a new computer and I can use it, and my air in Cambridge remains reasonably clean. Whereas that computer was manufactured in China, a lot of the energy is coming from much further afield. I don't pass any power plants on the way to work. Yet, if I live with a smoker, if I myself as a smoker, I can see effects, undeniable effects, really, now that we have the science, in my lifetime. I can see in the lifetime of people I know. Whereas it's much easier to look at something like climate change, anthropogenic climate change, which happens maybe over the course of many, many lifetimes, on a scale that's appreciable, and ignore it.
Well, I think that's part of the point. I agree with that. And I guess in general what I'd say to you, Rob, is that all of these situations are analogous, but not very tightly analogous. Just that it works very well here, and it didn't work very well. But the better one, which I think, if I may feed into you, is CFCs. which there it changed very quickly. But there, I think the point was we had a substitute right there. And there's no doubt if nuclear worked and the people were happy with nuclear, that would be fine, but it doesn't. The other point, if I may bring in, the sun shines down 100,000 times more energy than we use at the moment. So if we knew exactly how to capture and store that, all bets would be off.
I don't want to push it, but why I'm flagging that one is because I think it's another thing we ought to be doing. And it's precisely the analogy with the other, the three examples, where all the involvement of government, the involvement of people actually saying to government, we need change. And it comes back to that one first slide in the word, don't do anything. And I just don't want to leave it as something we should ignore, because I don't think we should. It's not a solution itself, but it's part of the solution. And eventually we're going to have to convince people it's a big enough problem. We're going to have to tackle it on that scale.
Well, if I can just come back in a general statement, that's why I said, what shall we do? What can we do? And there are lots of things, and I hope we'll hear some possibilities here. Which will be more successful? I think it's often difficult to predict. It depends on political will, personal will.
Well, yeah, just sticking with this theme of keeping consumption on the table. I think one of the important things to recognise is that, and this goes back to our point about population growth, about growth of affluence, of aspirations and so on, if we fail to take account of what consumption patterns are now, these are going to be extrapolated over a developing, over a growing population, over a developing economic region. This is, you know, the amount of damage that can be done simply by consumption patterns is going to go up and up and up. And that's going to mean that we're going to have even more possibilities in these other areas than I think can be managed. So if it is unlikely, then I wonder if we're all screwed anyway, which is why I wonder if we should stick to trying to make that less unlikely.
I was just going to suggest possibly a bit of a way out of this unpleasant, that you have human psychology up there, but I'd suggest maybe another category, since this is going into the Supreme Court, which is something to do with politics, because all of these examples which you mentioned, tobacco, as you say, we knew for a long time but it didn't change because of political interests involved. Alcohol, it's very much embedded in the systems of taxation and wealth distribution in our societies. Technology, yes, existed for aerosols, but technology doesn't appear in a vacuum. It's funded and developed according to perceived needs. So not with any sense of how predictable or quick any, you know, in terms of your scales might be, might I just suggest adding something about politics to that slide as a potential response to the situation from completely different
I couldn't agree more. Politics is very important, and I'm reminded that about 2 months ago I was in Canberra Airport in Australia, and one of the more influential civil servants in the Australian civil service, whose responsibility is on climate change and carbon dioxide, met with a man called Peter Cook, who's the head of the biggest sequestration organisation that's really had a good go in Australia. And they met, and I happened to be there. And the civil servant said, you know, we're just going to release 29 million to do some more carbon dioxide sequestration experimentation. And Peter said, 29 million, it's not enough. We need 39 million. And the civil servant said, well, 29 million is all you're going to get. And then there was this to and froing while I went, 29 million, 39 million. So I just stepped and I said, hey, you're both wrong. You're both wrong. What is really needed is for the Prime Minister to say, this is a problem that we have to solve. That would be worth more than 39, 390 million. And they both agreed and said, yeah, that would be fabulous. Gillard ain't going to do that, I can tell you. If I can just make some more comments and then I'll come back and answer the question. Two things that I haven't yet said are relevant is, one, this is a global problem. If England or Great Britain was to totally solve the carbon dioxide problem in the sense of it put no carbon dioxide out for some reason or other, that wouldn't do much difference. There's mixing in the atmosphere. It needs America, China, India, everybody to get involved. That's quite different to, for example, the problem when, let's say, the Thames was all silted up and the fish died. That was fixed up here. Before the fish came back to the Thames, nobody in India cared less. And when the fish came back, still nobody in India cared less. It was just a problem here. So it's a global problem. And except for CFCs, I think it is the first global problem. The second thing, which I haven't said and maybe should have already, is the inertia of the system is decades. If we stop things now, suddenly, it would take many decades. And that was hinted at by you when you said we really have to look into the future. We may see that things are terrible in the future. And that is something that I'm sure all of you know, but I should specifically say. Catherine. Damien?
I'd just like to make one of Hume's apology as well. I think the use of the word change is one that catches my eye, because I think human psychology is something that's very a tricky subject, but I think people respond very often to economic stimuli. So I don't think it requires a change in psychology, but rather a change in the stimuli. We've seen already that human consumption patterns can change very, very rapidly in response to certain stimuli. Mobile phones, the adoption of mobile phones has just been phenomenal, and then the adoption of different iterations of those phones and different features within those phones. And so when given these kind of reasons to change, and I think economics is a very strong one.
Well, I think it's difficult. Let me first say my wife is a psychologist, so I know something about it. But she and I have arguments that's like trench warfare between the actual calculations of risks and what might happen, and the perception. Felicia will frequently say, don't give me this 1 in 100. It's irrelevant, totally irrelevant. What is relevant is what I feel. And a wonderful example of this, I was asked to chair a working group on terrorism. And one of the people we interviewed was an extremely wealthy businessman who lived some 20 miles to the west of London, and for various reasons it was appropriate to interview him. This was before 7/7, and he told us the government is saying that there's going to be a bomb attack on the tube. I no longer take the tube, changing his human psychology. It's not worthwhile. And I somehow sniffed that I could get somewhere, and I said to him, you drive in, do you? And he said, yes. And I said, you bought a special car to drive in. He said, yes, how do you know? I have an Aston Martin. Well, I told him, the risk of death in an Aston Martin, I said, you use it on weekends. Yeah. Much, much larger. Felicia would say, don't give me the calculations, it's the perception. He felt he was safer. Okay, that first line, I think you've said to me I need to expand a lot, and you're right.
Since there's no economist in the room, wanted to remark, I wondered if economics, bringing economics into the picture might help here, because right now the economy is not doing very well globally, and somehow the process can create more jobs, then that might.
I'll be really brief because I know you want to move on.
No, I don't.
I mean, we do have here a lot of people from the Cambridge Programme for Sustainability Leadership, and together we do a lot of work with large corporates. Ron will be able to sort of chip in on this as well. And my impression actually is I would actually change that from unlikely to actually probably the most likely. I don't think it's a brilliant example, but analogy, but you gave the example of CFCs, which was largely industry driven. And certainly a lot of work that we do with various large corporates, there's a big momentum starting to happen in terms of large corporates starting to exactly change consumption patterns. And by the very nature of global supply chains, they can start to get around some of the issues that you were alluding to about the global nature of the problem. So I think actually there's much more hope than that.
Ron, what would you say? Ron, what would you say?
Which bit of the question?
I'd like you to say anything, but in particular, do you think I'm being too pessimistic in saying unlikely?
I think you have to specify whether you're talking globally or whether you're talking nationally or locally. They're very, very different questions. I mean, I don't know the answer to this, and there may be someone here who does, but you know, what fraction of the population, global population, is actually aware of climate change and actually makes any association between any change which they think they see and human activity? And I suspect that it's quite small. But most of the world's population live in deprived areas with very low, poor standards of education. And indeed, you know, a lot of people just don't know where tonight's dinner's coming from. And they find it very hard, or would find it very hard, to get involved in these. So I think you have to be specific. I mean, I agree with the people who say, look, within a community like that we live in, it is possible to make changes. And I think the way very quickly drink driving became socially unacceptable in the group, you know, the age group sort of 18 to 30 was really quite remarkable. And that happened over 10 years, something of that kind. When I think how we behaved when I was in that age, it's quite appalling by present day standard. But big shift there. But other shifts, I think, are much more difficult, and certainly global shifts are really a different question.
Well, I might just comment on Ron's point. You see that China, which has a huge population, is putting out as much as the United States. How many people in China, to take Ron's point? I wonder how many people in Australia really. Well, I know that most of the people in Australia are not keen on doing anything.
The government in China gets it very clearly. I mean, they have probably the most technocratically sophisticated government in the world. And if, you know, they can do the sums, they believe in climate change, and they know that if climate change progresses the way you're suggesting, a lot of people are, China is going to be one of the big losers.
What about India?
Much more difficult.
India has government elected and China doesn't. Yeah. So I think we've got to go back to political ecology. We have to go back to political economy. If you're going to talk about human psychology, I think that one of the impulses is to think we're talking about individuals as opposed to what is it that makes people run for government? What is it that makes, you know, IPCC comes out whenever it was and says if the world's temperature goes up by 2 degrees, then GDP in Great Britain is going to go down by 20%. All of a sudden there's a tension, but that attention lasted for about 45 minutes at the same time as they're bringing to put in more runways than Stansted. So there, you know, I mean, it's one of the reasons this is so amazingly complex, is that it's not one person's psychology, am I going to smoke or recycle, but as you said, if this government is dependent on arms sales, then probably it's going to be difficult to get this government really to stop selling arms to people, in the same way that fossil fuel, I mean, I work in the Arctic, you know, the idea that we're going to be able to stop random sort of development of oil up in the Arctic because it might ruin what is absolutely a crucial part of the global ecosystem, I don't see how to do it. I think it's much, much more complicated than are individuals going to be induced to change their behavior.
Excuse me, you said I had to talk for half an hour. You didn't say I could speak for 24 hours and go to each individual and do each little bit and make it.
You asked about India. I mean, India's a very important question. But the trick in India and really all the developed world, if one can do it, is to depoliticize climate change, so that it doesn't become a party political and political issue. I mean, we've done pretty well in this country. US has gone to the other extreme and it's miserable. Australia sort of balancing. And I mean, interestingly, we had a small delegation from the UK Parliament to the Indian Parliament before Christmas to talk to them about climate change. and really in say that although you can really hate people in other parties and disagree over all sorts of things, climate change is something that we can agree on. We actually, it was actually John Prescott and I, when most people don't know, John Prescott was the UK senior UK politician involved in the negotiation of Kyoto. And he's actually very well informed. I was totally astonished for years and a bit fun to travel with. Basically, we got a good reception, and various cross-party groups on climate change were actually set up while we were there. Whether it'll have any effect remains to be seen, but that politically is the trick, to try to depoliticize it.
Could I just give an example of, I think that summarizes in some sense what Ron has said, but is only one example. Dave King, who was the previous CSA and a very good CSA to the UK government, said we have to do something about climate change in Britain, because only if we do something can we then talk the Chinese and the Indians to do anything. That's very good of Ron to say correct and nodding of the head here. On the other hand, Senator Kerry, the unsuccessful presidential candidate, said you'd never get any discussion in the Senate going until China and India change something first. And I think those are the two contrasts that, in a sense, Ron was talking about in general. And it shows what you're up against. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, I do take the points that have been made about the distinction between locally based solutions and globally based solutions. But the only point I make, and I'll make it very briefly, is that the symbols of affluence that we create here, that created in the United States, that created in Australia and so on, these are the symbols of affluence which are imitated in the developed world and so on. Yeah. And that's what I meant when I said, well, if we do not tackle these consumption patterns, these are the things that will be extrapolated elsewhere. And that's why I think that has to take a certain amount of primacy.
Women first. I'm sorry, you're not going to hit me over the head for that.
Sorry, I was going to say depoliticising. I think when I mention politics, I don't mean in the sense of party politics. I mean in terms of exactly this question. How is wealth distributed in our society? How much energy do we think we all want to have, and how are we going to organise that? That kind of politics, talking about power, and who gets to make these kinds of decisions, doesn't go away with party divisions. Mm-hmm.
I reckon we should use symbols of affluence. Absolutely.
We should use, sir?
Use a symbol of affluence. If it's going to be imitated in other places, well, then make carbon sequestration a symbol of affluence.
Neil.
Surely we have to separate the psychological questions related to reducing consumption to psychological questions relating to a solution. Now, what was said about taxation, economics and China can actually fit together, because we've got at the moment the most favourable economic environment for capital projects at any time in our lifetimes. Borrowing costs for governments, providing you're not Spain and Greece, are absolutely at rock bottom. Next, we've got very large sovereign funds keen to invest in infrastructure programs. Now, if we bring those together, what you're actually looking for is a solution to create the income that can support the capital investment. Now, for a couple of generations, we've managed to live with the idea of death duties, estate tax. If we have bringing to the population a birth tax, it's interesting that a birth tax of something like £5 per birth worldwide would support something like £5 billion of capital investment. So if we don't look at reducing consumption, but providing it scientifically possible, we look at dealing with the problem by sequestration or whatever, then what we're talking about is, can we support that economic model?
Please.
I set this hair running, and if I use an analogy about rabbit and they're breeding like mad, whatever. I think what we're all saying is that it's not just, we don't like the word soil out there, and the legislation.
Slow meant the timescale in which it takes place. Unlikely. So you can't. Unlikely you can dislike, but slow you can't.
I think what we're saying is, in all of this, it's we need some sort of legislation, and not in a particularly party-driven sense. Absolutely not. But there is a consensus that it has to be at that scale, and I think that's what we're all trying to say about that top line. That it's something bigger is needed, and probably through legislation. You mentioned the CFCs, I mentioned the earlier two examples, because that's where legislation does change patterns, and hence the reason we're introducing it. And so I think that we're sort of converging on different models, how can you encourage people to do it, but a bit of coercion, whether it's a £5 birth tax or whatever.
Well, can I say, make an addendum to that, which I think is important, and I'll come on to a little bit later. I had planned to come on to a little bit later. I believe there's money to be made from sequestration. I believe that there are companies that could really make a considerable amount of money. I said that to the CEO of one big company. He said, but only the second company can make money. The first company in this, and we're waiting for the others. And I told him the story, some of you may not know this, that when penguins are on ice floes and they need to get krill or fish, they go to the edge of the floe and they look, because there can be whales and sharks down there that cause them a lot of difficulty. They look to see if all is well, then they go, and they knock their neighbour in, and if the neighbour gets taken, then they don't go in. If the neighbour is all right, then they jump in. That's my model of business. Anyhow, he said quite right. That's exactly how my company works. Let me just say rather quickly, we could get carbon possibly from the atmosphere. That, I'm going to say, is unlikely. That's very expensive. And there, the small amount, 395 parts per million, is not good. There is three different ways of taking the carbon dioxide from power sources. I don't want to go into the details here, post-combustion, pre-combustion, burning it in oxygen rather than air. There's also the possibility of storing it in cement, and this must be a wonderful possibility, because I'm saying this between friends in closed doors. This company, Solera, which is, I think, operated out of Boston, has got a huge amount of money from the Australian government to put carbon dioxide into cement, which shows it must work. Here's some pictures of some carbon dioxide capture plants. They have been installed in some power plants as they're being built. There's the question of refitting it. That comes into details about which I don't think we need go in here. There's the question of transport. Now, even here, you can have a difference of opinion. I don't think carbon dioxide will be transported many hundreds or thousands of miles, but some people disagree with that and say that there might be a huge transport. Now, I think this slide is interesting. This is the sequestration in millions of tons of carbon dioxide per annum, and this is operational at the moment. But let me just give you a scale here. I know it says 80 million tons, but just to make it simple, let's say across the slide is 100 million tons.
What does operational mean?
That are working at the moment. This is now going. What I'm going to show you is what's planned and then what goes on in the future. But just to get a scale here, this is, let's say, across the slide, 100 million tonnes. So if you now do another 10, you get a billion tonnes. And now you do another 32, so we're doing 300. Which direction are we in? I think this is south or something. You must be way into Spain by then, before you get into what the actual amount is. So this is piddling, the amount that's operational at the moment, i.e. going now. This is the final stage, or under construction, i.e. might be going on. And this is now what's planned. So the most optimistic at the moment, sequestration is indicated here. I haven't actually summed it all up, but let's say it's 200 million tons. We're putting in 32 billion. So it's really a long, long way to go. There has been some sequestration in Sleipner. This is the most famous case. It's been going since 1996. And I think this is a very interesting story, that the Norwegian oil company was approached by the government and said, how much would it cost to sequester the carbon dioxide. And this is how I'm being told the story. Ron may know it better, and please correct me if I'm wrong. And as I was told, they were asked how much would it cost, and they said, oh, $65 a ton to sequester it. And so the Norwegian government said, well, we'll give you $45 a ton as a tax break. So that will help you slightly. And they sequestered it happily at $15 a ton. And that's been going on a million tons a year since 1996. And now, there's some fascinating fluid mechanics that goes on here. And now if we close the doors for the next hour, I'm going to tell you about differential equations and similarity solutions and all that sort of stuff, only in my mind. Here's a coal-burning power station, just to give you an indication, a 500 megawatt coal power plant, sort of typical size, puts out 10,000 tons of carbon dioxide per day, and Sleipner sequests 3,000 tons of carbon dioxide per day. So that's the biggest, longest continuing sequestration is only a third of a power plant. There's also some work being done in Ensala that's been going on for about 5 or 6 years. Virtually no data has come out of that. I sometimes wonder whether there's any data that's gone into it or being taken. I just don't know. Now the question of costs. I'm not an economist. There are no economists here, so we can't have a detailed discussion, but Nick Stern wrote a report on this, and he said it would cost roughly 2% of the GDP to sequester the carbon dioxide. The point is that that's about 1 year's growth. That's really rather small. The extra cost per unit for capture, transport and storage, depends how you calculate, but something like 20 or 100%. Now, I think it's an important point, and again, I'm happy to be interrupted and told that I'm wrong. The 20 to 100% increase is not much at all. Not much at all. And that's why I believe that money can be made out of this and something can be done. And in support of my argument, I'll tell you that in this country, we pay three times the amount for petrol than one does in the US. And yet the 140 million cars in this country, people seem to drive more or less as much as they want. There aren't a whole series of people in this country who aren't driving, even though their salary is less. It costs three times, I mean, just a per capita value, more. Just out of interest sake, or for me, Australia's twice as much as the US, and the same conclusions hold. It makes no difference. Let me just show you the US sequestration opportunities. There really is a lot of space available in the US and in Europe and elsewhere. These are the seven largest storage reservoirs in the US. And you see, if you total them up, you get 3,631 billion tons. And you can see how accurately this has been done, in that this number is presented to four significant figures. So that's how you get faith in the people who present this. The US would need to store something like 30 billion tons a year, so there's some 300 years storage that we know of. This is now the sort of the second last slide. This is a little bit out of date, but not very much out of date, a year or two. The current sequestration projects, and of course there's Sleipner, which off the northeast coast of Great Britain, which we've talked about. There's quite a lot going on in America. Weyburn, a very important part in Canada. The Otway project, with which I'm associated, a very, very sophisticated and successful field trial experiment. The Gorgon project, which is a big sequestering project, and I'm smiling because I've been trying for the last 2 years to get involved with that or to find out something. I can write as much as I like. And they write back and say, oh, thank you very much for contacting us. We'll let you know later. I'm not getting anywhere there. In China a little bit. In Sala, which I mentioned, in Algeria. What I think is much more interesting in this map is not the places where there are sequestration projects, but where there are no sequestration projects, i.e. there's no local experience being gained. Nothing in all of the southern part of Africa. Nothing in South America or in Mexico. nothing in the former Soviet Union, and I think that's going to be a problem. And the Otway project was set up, I know this explicitly, and I'm sure it's true of other places, explicitly so that Australia could gain some experience in this. They didn't want to just take it in from elsewhere, or they thought they couldn't. So the conclusions is that global warming is probably occurring on large worldwide consequences. My younger son, let me be clear, my younger son, who's an engineer in Australia, gets always annoyed when I show this, saying, "Daddy, you've got to say it is definitely occurring." And Daddy says, no, I think it's only probably occurring. In science, it's extremely difficult to be definite on cutting-edge ideas. We're putting in 32 gigatons, of which 0.03% is currently being sequestered. Really rather small. Fluid mechanics can play a large role, and I have a graduate student who I hope soon will not be a graduate student and finish off, who's done some lovely fluid mechanics on that. And finally, I think we all agree with this, that we must do something about this global problem. And again, the guy said, no, we don't.
What's the problem with climate change?
Sorry?
What's the problem? Because I don't think it is one problem. we always talk about climate change as a problem, yeah. But I don't think it is a problem. It's many, many problems. So if I say to you, temperature, carbon dioxide is going up, I don't care. Temperature's going up. Well, that's good. I like warm temperatures.
I see. What's the problem? I think I hinted, more than hinted that at the beginning. It means more severe storms. It means more frequency of storms. It means flooding. It means drought in various cases. It also means, and this is not said very often, advantageous things for some parts of the world. Northern Canada may be able to have two growing seasons and produce more. Let me be really crude and say, do I care less that old people are likely to die more often if I can be warmer for a while?
That's exactly what I mean. It's that the scientific communication needs to be much more finely targeted and tuned to the audience rather than on almost alarmist, we have this problem, and you see it everywhere. Without a sophisticated approach to explaining, rather than being shocked that people don't understand.
Well, I think this leads to the fascinating question, of which I'm far from an expert: how do you describe these things to the person in the street? What can you say to them? Do they understand about variability and what that means? To them, as I indicated before, 385 parts per million doesn't seem very much, and 1.5 degrees. And I can't help but tell you, by far, 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 the most impressive politician in Australia is a man called Malcolm Turnbull, who was unfortunately defeated by one vote to be leader of the Liberal Party. Have you met him? He's terrific, absolutely terrific. And I met him 2 months ago, and we talked for half an hour, and then he said, "I believe you know something about climate change." I said, "Oh, a little bit." And he said, "Can I try something out on you?" And he talked about warming up of the oceans and that leading to more water in the atmosphere and that changing the greenhouse gas contents and hence the temperature. And then, and then after 5 minutes of complicated description, he said to me, "Is that correct?" And I said, "Yes, Malcolm, that's absolutely correct. You've got it right." And he smiled. He said, "Good, I'm pleased. But it's obvious, isn't it?" "No," I said, "I don't think it's obvious." He said, "But it's obvious." And I said, "Look, let's not have an argument about what the word obvious means, because I don't quite know what that means. What I will say, though, is that's a pretty difficult argument to make for the man in the street and to take that up." And he said, "No, it isn't. It's easy. He must be able to understand that. There's this huge feedback system and negative and all that." No, all politicians have some lacunae, and that was his.
But I want to go back to your Roland's comment about the word probably,
yeah,
in light of what you were just saying too, and also the one problem. I think you should change that, and I understand you don't want to say is occurring, but is almost certainly occurring, because I think it's part of what you were just saying about how do we get the average person to realise this isn't something which is just
probability and having these views on it. Because I think you could ask the question of us all, split us into two groups, those who think it is or isn't occurring, but we've got to do something. If it isn't occurring, well, okay, we're doing something unnecessary, but I suspect most people in this room believe it is occurring, and it's our responsibility then to be clearer about the fact it is occurring and that we want to inform others.
Who's our? I think this is an important point. Are you talking about university lecturers in Cambridge? Are you talking about the population of Great Britain? Who's our?
I'm talking about the our of each of us as just individuals.
It's a big ask.
Yep. That's how things go.
Three unconnected points that I've managed to get in before. Firstly, relating to Ron's point, I don't think one should underestimate the power of the poor, especially those who are living in coastal areas and nomadic and agriculturalists, because they, from experience that I've encountered, are actually encountering immediately the effects of climate change. And as they become to realise, and this is happening in Africa, it's happening in areas of China that I'm aware of, and once they begin to realise that this is affecting their life and livelihood, I think they will move from individuals to local groups to become more powerful on their governments.
Can they convince themselves that it's human activity that is actually causing...
It's amazing how sophisticated those that I've been involved with are, actually.
There was a World Bank survey that was done a couple of years ago, which we surveyed 30 or 40 different countries around the world. Now, you always have to question surveys exactly how they actually gathered the data, but just taking the raw results, the level of concern in developing countries about climate change was higher than it was in the
past. Absolutely, because
it's much more in their face than sitting in an urban environment.
Your story about the Aston Martin, I mean, do you think the people who couldn't afford to buy the Aston Martin didn't want to stop travelling on the tube? They just couldn't afford to buy Aston Martin to do it with. But they knew as much as everybody else that the risks were there.
Well, I think it's an interesting question. I don't want us to get diverted about the people travelling on the tube, because here again, I'm afraid it's the calculation rather than the perception. The chance of a terrorist attack while you travel on the tube is minimal. There are many things that are more dangerous, and I can't help but say I have a colleague who will never travel in a train. He'll even wait for the next train if he can't get a seat that has his back to the direction of motion, because that's really much, much safer. And he cycles down to the train station. It's a 20-minute cycle ride. He's a very important person. Time is valuable. So he dictates to his secretary as he cycles along with one hand. But when he gets to the train station, he has to have his back to the direction of travel. Ridiculous. No, it would say Felicia's perception.
I mean, look, it's not quite as ridiculous as you say, because there are risks which you can control, in a sense.
He doesn't have to dictate as he cycles down.
The guy who rides his bike may practice riding and dictating at the same time. In other words, that all of that bit of risk is in his control. Once he gets on the tube, it isn't.
If I may say, I agree totally with what you're saying, but that's going into perception again. That's the question
that's
of
what we're
perception.
About, though, perception that drives them being able to take for stronger action by government. So we were talking about perception, not actual.
Well, and you know, here's the argument. Is it perception or. I could tell you another story, which I won't.
Wait,
but
just my other 2 points. Firstly, in terms of these feedback loops that we've talked a lot about, I haven't seen anything that has begun to put in increasing deaths. Increasing deaths and economic problems arising from climate change. And if, you know, these graphs are going in that kind of direction, I would have thought that by the end of the century there'd begin to be feedback loops coming in there. And just my last point, so we don't get into another discussion and I don't get in. And this is maybe a little bit joking, but some of the biggest drops in temperature over time in the Earth's climate have been volcanoes. Has there been any thought of trying to create that kind of effect?
That, of course, has been thought about a lot. A medium-sized volcano, Pinatubo or something like that, changes the temperature by about 1 degree for 2 years, or at maximum 1 degree for 2 years. You really need a magnificent eruption that kills everybody around there. That's a difficult thing to suggest. And if I may give you an analogy, which I think fascinating, again, Ron may be able to correct me on some of the details. In about 1965, there were some earth tremors registered in Texas, about magnitude three or four. So definitely noticeable, but not enormous. And after a while, the seismologists realized that this was just in an area that was controlled by the Army, and the U.S. Army was putting waste liquid that it no longer wanted into the rocks. That was lubricating the rocks and letting the slip. The obvious conclusion, why don't you ask the mayor of San Francisco to lubricate San Francisco and have magnitude threes and fours and have them every morning at 8 o'clock? It would be fabulous, except what happens if a magnitude 8 went off or magnitude 9 went off? Then you get rid of a lot of people. Terribly sorry, it was non-linear. First of all, I don't think we have any idea how to set off a large volcanic eruption. Even if we did, you know, the thing that I always find fascinating is the energy in natural events swamps everything that is in man-made events. So the energy needed to set up a super-duper volcanic eruption, even if we knew how to do it, would be quite large. But to come to your first point, to my knowledge, again, Ron may know better, I don't think any of these predictions have taken into account their back effect on global population and what that might then do. That would be quite a complicated business.
Really. I mean, the one thing you didn't mention there as a serious consequence is the disruption of surface drainage and water supply and its consequences for food production.
Yeah.
And that looks to me likely to be the first real global impact. As you know, one of the consequences or kind of changes you've been describing is that certain areas which are marginal at the moment will simply become uninhabitable, and areas which are reasonably habitable at the moment will become marginal. So we're going to have massive shifts of population associated with reduction, apparently, in world food supply. And what my biological friends tell me is that really what we're looking for is more or less twice the production of food from the same surface area. And it's not impossible. It's going to involve GM, and it's going to involve a lot of things that people will be uncomfortable with. But that is the challenge, and doing that with a disrupted rainfall water supply is not going to be easy.
But sorry, Emily.
An important caveat on that as well, because I think it often gets overlooked, is that, as somebody mentioned earlier, there are positive benefits as well as negative.
Yeah.
When considering that, it's really important to understand the timescale of change. And to actually take advantage of a positive change, it may be, you know, northern Russia may become more suitable for crop growth, but to be able to take advantage of that requires quite a considerable amount of time in terms of putting in the resources to change what a crop we're going to plant and everything, the infrastructure necessary and so forth, whereas the negative impact can occur up on a much faster time scale. So you need to understand not just that there are pros and cons, but also the different time scales in which this could be.
Well, I think, I mean, what Ron says is a very important point, but I think I'm going to back off a little bit and rest on my statement that I made a little jokily, but there is a lot of content to it. I think nothing's as difficult to predict as the future. Who knows what other aspects might come into play? And to give an example that I've thought a lot about, I bet people interested in health in 1938 or so thought about world health and what they could do. Not one of them, I bet, said, well, why don't we support old Florey? Florey will discover penicillin, or the Australian say he discovered penicillin, and change everything, and he'll even save the commander of the army.
I mean, that would be nice, and this is the old George Bush argument, you know, technology will save us. Well, you know, that saying was magic around the corner. I mean, there may be some.
I agree totally that my example was extreme, and that was a big step change. You're bringing up, in my opinion, a very important problem about crop growth and crop efficiency. How do you know, really, whether that's going to be 50%, 150% in 20 years' time? You know, and things could change there.
Things could change. Well, they're going to have to.
Well, that's the more important point, I think, that they're going to have to change and be more efficient.
And if we're going to spend billions and billions, should we not be putting that money towards tidal barrages and offshore wind farms and solar power, etc., and indeed setting up some kind of grid where electricity can run between countries? I mean, it just seems to me we're not going to get off fossil fuels if we can...
Well, my response to that is, of course, in general, you're correct. The question is, what do we put the money into and how will it work? And coming back to the exchange I just had with Ron, wind farms are definitely not the answer because it's just not possible to get, you know, there's a total amount of wind and it's not going to increase by a factor of 100. Solar, as I said, there are 100,000 times more energy coming in than we need. If we really knew that, you know, the Flory equivalent, who's an undergraduate in Cambridge at the moment, is going to invent ways to capture and store that. That would be terrific. Is it going to happen? We've been trying to capture solar power for 60 years or so, and not been much of a improvement. Yeah, but that's where I think my Flory example is actually relevant, because it may just be that suddenly we'll capture much more.
There's a second part, which is more that the money that goes into technology for carbon sequestration isn't going to see out coal altogether. I mean, we are running out of coal. So
not in my lifetime, unfortunately.
But look, the thing is, what you said is quite right, but how do we get from there to here? And there's enormous inertia.
Do we get from there to here? Excuse me, from here to there rather than from there to here.
But built in the way we're doing it. And it takes years to build a new power station or to build a solar array or to develop a technology for storing these things. So fundamentally, it's very hard to see any practical way of getting off fossil fuels in under 50 years. And that is pretty optimistic. So, if you look at the amount of coal and gas that's going to be burnt between now and then during that transition, we really don't want that CO2 to go into the atmosphere. And that's the argument for CCS. I mean, I hate CCS because as a concept, but I think it is inevitable. I think we've really got to try and do it.
Catherine.
Can I just make a quick point about renewables? The amount of energy that you harness for different renewable technologies, for you to deploy enough renewables that you could get enough energy to adjust the UK situation, it would be really intrusive. You'd have to cover so much land, put up such a length and tidal barrier, cover so much area of sea for offshore wind farms to get enough energy that it's going to be noticeable to the public. You're not going to get away with doing that without people seeing it. It will be intrusive.
There's plenty of other intrusive stuff already.
Climate change is pretty interesting.
Well, I was wondering on carbon sequestration, if you could speak a little bit to the issue of whether it will stay put, because on the list of pros and cons, this is what always comes up. You get the cautionary tale about the natural processes in the lake in Africa, is it Cameroon or wherever, and you know that's very powerful emotionally for people because it's, you know, you go to sleep at night, the gas bubbles up in the lake, you wake up in the morning and you know you don't wake up. There's that, right? But we've also, in the little bit that I've read on technically, you know, where people try to identify suitable sites for carbon sequestration, they're looking at the site as though it is what it is. But we've also got the approval of fracking and uncertainties related to other kinds of industrial processes that may or may not be able to seismically open up fissures or this kind of thing. You know, to, would we then have to have, you know, would it not just be a matter of, like, you know, monitoring individual sorts, but doing the entire industry talking to one another?
Well, my own view, and I'd be interested in what Ron's view is also, is that, of course, this is something we have to be concerned about. Cameroon was an isolated incident which is now controlled, and in all likelihood it's not going to happen again. I'm going to have to say this and emphasize that my group is working on leakage, and they've done some, my group, not me, have done some wonderful fluid mechanics, and I think we have a better understanding of that. My own view is that all of these processes have some possible problems associated with them. You try to understand things as best as you possibly can and try to understand what will happen, how you'll handle it if it would go wrong. I don't think leakage is necessarily a big problem. And then I can't resist saying that when I was doing some leakage, I had a director of research of a company whose name I'm not going to mention, of course, come to my lab, and I showed him a leakage experiment, and I said I can calculate how much leaks and everything about this, and it could be quite a lot. And he said, what if you stop the leak? And I said, I don't understand. And he said, if you stop the leak, how much more comes out? I said, if you stop the leak, no more comes out. And he said, good, because my company knows how to stop any leak that exists. Which company was that, Ron? Nowadays, when I do the experiment, I say, I'll show you how I do it. But I think we can control these. But, you know, the same thing could be said about planes. You know, planes which we develop now are enormously safe. They could fall out of the ground. They could fall onto the ground. The other story which I like, and if you don't mind my asking you a question in exchange, say it was 1880 here. And in this talk, I said to you, I have this fabulous idea. It's called a car. It's going to move along. It's going to go at 70 miles an hour. And there are going to be other cars going 2 feet away from it in 70 miles an hour the other direction, 140 miles an hour relative. In the United States, it's going to kill 45,000 people a year. Right? So that's much more than 9/11 did. What do you think, ladies and gentlemen? Should we introduce this thing called the car? Now what we'd say, yeah, we can make it safe, and accidents are rather rare, except for the 45 million.
Can we just on the leakage? I mean, it's important for people to realise that CO2 is seeping out of the interior of the earth everywhere.
Yeah,
I spent 10 years of my life here measuring that and other gases that seep. And in places like the seepage is particularly strong in volcanic areas. And in Italy, I think it's somewhere between 6 and 10 people a year die through natural CO2 poisoning. And what happens is because CO2 is denser than air, ponds, and sits in hollows. And you know, people may go to sleep or something like that out in the countryside, and as someone said, just not wake up. They lose about 200 animals the same way. So people do get used to living with CO2. And in areas, I mean, all the mineral water areas, see, a vast amount of CO2 is actually coming to the surface, and quite a small amount is actually in your Perrier or what have you. Okay, I mean, these things can be managed, and the fact that we actually see natural gas deposits in Britain or concentrations in reservoirs in various parts of the world, and in fact you see helium, which is a much more diffusive gas than CO2, trapped by natural, if you like, natural umbrellas underground, means that in fact natural barriers can be really pretty effective over quite long times. I mean, there's always some detection through, but it can be a sufficiently small level not to bother us very much.
I mean, that would be your view. Yeah, no, I agree totally. And to add, as you did, that there's natural leakage and that does do some damage. And I think we're beginning to understand. Sam?
It's worth mentioning, I would have thought, that there are a number of trapping mechanisms. If you wait long enough, the CO2, for example, can dissolve it into a saline solution and then it's no longer less dense.
Well, that, to make more general, is there are processes that you can control and will likely happen that will make it safer. I think it is possible to make sequestration sufficiently safe that it could easily be acceptable. But again, I mean, this comes to how you predict the future. If some guy, instead of closing the valve, opens the valve because he's totally drunk, as it happened in Chernobyl, it doesn't matter what you do. Emily.
But you've been setting this all up as a sort of either-or.
Sorry?
You've been setting this all up as either-or in terms of solutions. So you've been saying, either we change human psychology, which is going to be difficult, or we do carbon capture and storage, or we do these various renewables. Now, as you say, it's impossible to predict the future, but with our current understanding, we know that not one of those solutions on our current understanding is capable of the numbers adding up to be the solution alone. And given that we're not capable of predicting the future, it's very difficult at this point, given the uncertainties associated with each of them, to be able to predict which one might end up being more or less of the solution. And given that, the appropriate response in the face of that uncertainty is to go for a portfolio of different solutions, and that surely has to be the way forward. And in that case, then the conversation needs to be one about communication to the to the public about which of these different possible solutions. It's about what legislative framework, again, as we were mentioning earlier, we need to put in place in order to allow that portfolio of different solutions. But I'm not sure that it's very helpful to fixate too much on, is my solution better or worse than your solution?
No, I hope I didn't give the... No, I know that yours is better, Emily. I understand that. I hope I didn't give the impression I'm saying it's either or and we're making a decision. In fact, I don't think I tried to put that in the balance. And I agree, we have to do as much as we possibly can. And in a sense, this discussion has brought this out, talking about political moves, economic moves, human population moves, technical moves. Yeah, I agree with that we have to do all of it.
I think we've had a great discussion, but it's going to carry on.
I'll tell you.
I'm conscious that there's loads more questions.
Could I just let this lady ask? Because this is her first question.
I was going to say, surely in terms of a man in the street or a man in the field, you present the problem in terms that he/she will understand, not necessarily in legal terms, but in medical terms. So actually, whoever you're talking to, you being God or whatever,
Since we're out of time, I can say in my head I have enough difficulty presenting science to my undergraduates in the way that they can understand to know how to present a complicated problem like this to the man in the street. That's, I think, part of the difficulty.
We have a different form of consumption, which is wine and snacks. Which means that there's still time to engage in discussion, but in a slightly different mode.
We certainly don't want to curtail the discussion, all the questions, but maybe if you'd like to grab some refreshments and then we can continue. But in the short term, then, can we thank Herbert for an excellent discussion, prompting lots more questions. So thank you very much.